Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINKCAST at checkout, you will save a gigantic, astronomical, massive 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINKCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Advice
for
go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINKCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I am Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. You know, today's guest is the very funny duo behind Britannic, whose weird and hilarious short form work on YouTube. Short form, you know.
Short
and already
shortened the
it's
word
very
short form.
Firm what we do? Yes, you made it shorter, kind of.
I did. That's what I do. I like to make things short. That's my goal. I don't know where I'm going with that, so I'm going to keep on rolling with my pre-written intro. They started on YouTube, and then that got them onto SNL and It's Always Sunny, and now they've decided to dominate April of 2026 for some reason with 2 movies you need to check out. First up, they wrote and directed Pizza Movie, an absolutely bonkers comedy about 2 college nerds on an impossible quest to get to their dorm lobby and pick up a pizza while they're both tripping balls. You can see this right now on Hulu, and they also
classic drug odyssey story. You guys,
yeah,
to the
excellent entry
into the
genre.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll get into that in a second. But they also wrote the script for the upcoming Over Your Dead Body, starring Samara Weaving and Jason Segel. I saw both. I love both, and I'm very excited to have these two on the show, especially since they've somehow never seen David Cronenberg's The Dead Zone up until now, and have rectified that mistake just for us. We're gonna talk about all that, but first things first. Please welcome Brian McElhaney. Fuck, I already fucked up your name. I asked you how to do it.
It's close enough. It's like every telemarketer when I picked up the phone as a kid. You got closer than most.
Okay, good. I'm going to go with that. I got a B minus on it. And Nick Kocher to the KINKCAST. Welcome, both gentlemen.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you for gritting your teeth through that unbearable intro. Now we can get on with the actual show.
You know, Eric, I think, look, Britannic is known for going off the rails. I think these 2 movies are perfect examples of, like, taking the audience straight off the rails. So it's good that you started thematically by...
Yes,
yeah,
I do that
going
totally
off
on
the
purpose.
Rails is the only way we can really handle any kind of media, any kind of writing. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of all we do.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I saw Over Your Dead Body at the premiere the other night at Vidiot's. Talk about an audience that was thrilled to go off the rails. I love the build of the reaction to that movie, which starts out like a warring couple comedy and becomes a horror fest. And we're happy to have you on the show because Stephen King writes horror, of course. And it seems like that's a huge influence on you. Pizza Movie 2 had some like horror elements to it, right? Is that a part of your DNA?
It's kind of freaky at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think Pizza Movie is the things that influence that are far and wide. Like, there's references to Mike Myers' movie Cat in the Hat and, like, you
Wait,
know.
There is?
Yeah. And
Where
Hearts
did you put
of Darkness.
That in?
It's in the framing of a one shot. I remember, like, having to search. It was in a meeting with our DP, and I was like, have you guys ever seen Mike Myers' Cat in the Hat? And everyone was like, no, obviously
Especially
not.
Our DP would not be happy.
And I was
that.
Like, I had to find a clip on some website that gave my computer a virus to be like, okay, there's a shot where he rises up into frame holding a baseball bat. I want to do that here.
Ah, all right. That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
it was far and way out. We kind of took our homages from everywhere. Even though it's a bonkers comedy that becomes kind of horror-y, if there was a shot from an animated film or from a surrealistic, Fellini film like that, we just felt right for the moment, we would sort of like wedge it in there. It's really like throw the kitchen sink at a movie kind of movie.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of different, the drug that the characters are on in Pete's movie has different phases, and each phase is kind of its own high concept comedy film. And in fact, there are references to those that are pretty apparent, like Liar Liar, Freaky Friday. Like it's kind of like I don't know. It's a real like potluck of different movies that all came together to create a very foul smelling stew.
That's why I said it's like an Odyssey story, It's go on this journey, you encounter the different people. I think you and Christopher Nolan should really compete for who has the best Odyssey film.
I agree. The competition's already started for the Oscar campaign.
Between he also has a lot Odyssey. Of He has a lot of Mike Myers Cat in the Hat references in that movie. So
famously, in all of his films.
He loves it.
We had a really hard time titling our movie. And so we would send out emails to our friends being like, hey, like originally we wanted to call the movie, Oh God, No, Please Make It Stop. And Hulu, when we pitched that to them, said, that's a joke, right? And we said, oh, yeah, no, we don't actually mean that. And then... So then we were sending out emails to people being like, here's the options of titles, vote for which one you like, also write in your own. And I think three people independent of each other all suggested the title The Odyssey But With Pizza, which...
I'm so glad I'm in tune on your wavelength.
We didn't pitch that to Hulu, figuring that they might at a certain point just cut us out of the process completely.
When we shot it, like even on the slate, it was called the Untitled Britannic Pizza Movie. And so we're like, okay, that's what it's going to be, just temporary. And now we'll figure out an actual title in the post process. Then we went through 100 different titles, probably more, and then just landed on Pizza Movie. We just took out Untitled. Like that was such a long journey to come back to basically what we had in the beginning anyway.
It would have been fun if you did just the Odyssey and then in colon, like in the parentheses or whatever, Pizza Movie.
Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey.
Christopher
but with
Nolan's
pizza.
The Odyssey with pizza.
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't you go with Avatar 4, the pizza movie?
I was pitching, I was like, we could call this movie One Battle After Another, and it's accurate. I mean, that's what the movie is.
That's like when you see like there's a big Hollywood film, and in the grocery store they're selling like a homemade bootleg version of like Transmorphers.
Yes.
It's like that cost $20,000 to release.
That was a whole cottage industry, I feel like, where it's like the DVD bucket at CVS, and it was like, just I can't imagine. The margin on those movies must have been so narrow, or they were just full money laundering schemes for producers.
Or, as P.T. Barnum said, never underestimate the stupidity of the public. Like, there must have been people, there were certainly moms who were like, well, we have Transmorphers at home.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not that far from what happened to Stephen King and... Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man in the 90s, where they're like, oh, he has a story.
What happened with that?
Well, he wrote a short story that's sort of about like an ancient god, this eldritch god that is being summoned by a guy who's cutting lawns, right? Am I right, Eric, with this? Like,
he works for like a Greek god. This guy, he's a giant, huge, fat guy, and he mows lawns by telepathically moving the lawnmower and then stripping butt naked and going behind the lawnmower and eating all the clippings and or sometimes the remains of animals that end up being mowed.
What is this business model?
It's Pan. He worked for Pan, I believe.
It's crazy. And then they made like a science fiction script in the 90s. You guys have heard of The Lawnmower Man, right?
Yeah, of course.
It's like Pierce Brosnan.
I never saw it, but
it's like
for your next appearance.
It's like an AI, AI CG fest.
It's
sort of
VR.
Virtual,
it's all about
virtual
this guy
reality. That, yeah.
Yeah. The scientist that is pioneering VR for chimps at the beginning of the movie to make chimp warriors, and somehow he gets the idea to use this on his mentally handicapped next door neighbor.
This is a real movie. This is Stephen King. What's so great about his writing style, just after reading his book on writing, is that there's so many different books that talk about how you should write films for stories and everything, and everyone has their own different, you know, constructs and the way that they think you should approach it. But his is like, he just sort of starts writing and lets it come out of his imagination and doesn't really care about, you know, doesn't like arc the whole thing out or do this three act structure. I remember he says, like, in his book, he's like, how do you know when it ends? He's like, it ends because it's going to have to end at some point. I think that's just like a really great way to think about writing, not how we wrote our movie, but like because of that, like ideas and things come out that you would never put in your stories if you really had a group together who, like, you know, arced out the story and, you know, beated it out and, like, created the structure beforehand. You would go, okay, this lawnmower guy, maybe we shouldn't. Yeah, maybe he doesn't actually
fit.
It's
a little
weird. And this, right, exactly. And, like, because of that, like, the book's just like, you never really know where they're going. Mm-hmm. And when he has a detail that feels right and you don't know why, it comes out and it goes into the book. And it's just like, it's a great way to write, and again, not at all how we wrote Pizza Movie. We were incredibly trying to, like, figure out back to front, like, how everything is structured and fits together, and I don't know. I would love to write something the way he does one day.
Yeah, he was pissed off about it because they took the title of his book, they had the rights to the short story, and they just decided to add that title to a whole different movie, and I think he sued, had it removed, had his name removed. Got paid extra because he was like, you used me to sell the movie and it had nothing to do with me, so I get like 10%. It was a gangster move.
I have a theory that he made the most money from any of his work being adapted from Lawnmower Man, because not only did he get paid up front for having, you know, his story optioned, he got paid when he sued them the first time to get his name taken off of it, and then they released it on home video and forgot to take his name off of it. Oh, and he sued them again, and I think he won like a $25 million lawsuit or something.
Incredible.
Against it.
Yeah, oh, so, my God.
So it's the wacky world of Stephen King. But going back to like the Timu, you know, kind of transmorpher conversation here, Stephen King has somebody who does that for him. He self-publishes books where he has these really terrible covers that kind of look like Stephen King covers, and he uses the Stephen King font, and his name is Stephen R. King, spelled exactly the same ways, but the R is usually done like very narrow in the font. So it just goes Stephen R. King, you know, then some like thing, and you go, oh my God. So if you're like going through audio, you know, an audiobook app or going through like a Kindle thing, you might go, oh, here's a Stephen King book I don't know about. And I run a Stephen King show. I'm very familiar with pretty much everything that dude has ever written. And even I was like, oh, what's this? And I almost, you know, clicked on that stuff.
If it almost tricks you, then
yeah.
The rest of the public, no
chance.
The
grift is real. So, yeah.
Wow.
He does have his own version.
How often does Stephen King, since you guys know more than we do about this, how often do you feel like he enjoys the adaptation of his movies compared to not enjoying them? Because famously, he hates some of them. I mean, The Shining being one of the biggest examples. Does he normally like put a stamp of approval, do you feel like? Or is it half and half?
He's pretty, he's eased up over time. Like, he seems to appreciate variety. Like, didn't he tell Edgar Wright about The Running Man, like, it's faithful enough that I'm happy and it's different enough that I was interested. You know,
like,
he's interested in variety. Like, he liked some of the changes to, like, the recent Pet Sematary movie. He even liked the changes to the recent Firestarter remake, which most people did not, and radically changed his story. But
he does a little.
I just heard about, like, the thing that he did, the dollar,
Dollar babies.
What is it?
Dollar babies.
I think that's incredible. I think that's like such a wonderful thing. He did a thing where he was like, if you can license any of my short stories, I think it was. I mean, you might know this better than me. I'm going to butcher the thing. For a dollar, if you're like a film student and you make the movie for less than some budget point and it's a runtime of below 45 yeah. minutes or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't come with like distribution rights or ownership rights, but he will option the rights for, and it's not any of his short stories, because there are some that are, you know, actually optioned by people that, you know, make the big movies. But it was a list. I think he's had to discontinue that.
Oh, sure.
Recently.
But it's how Frank Darabont got his start.
Yeah. He was the very first Dollar Baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was just cool. A film student.
You could make them as a calling card or for a film festival or for a class, but you couldn't put it out. You couldn't sell it in the CVS DVD bin, you know.
Up until COVID, you couldn't even put it online, but like he relaxed that during COVID because, you know, all these poor students had put everything they had into, you know, these Dollar Baby adaptations, and then COVID hit, and then all these film festivals shut down, so nobody could actually see the stuff. So he relaxed it then, and the Darabont example. That's just kind of king in a nutshell. It's, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, I'm excited to run a show kind of about this guy, because that's just how he thinks, man. It's like when Darabont mailed him, like, or, you know, he just sent like a physical letter, I think, back in the early 80s, and was like, hey, I'm a big fan. I just left film school. I'm trying to make it in Hollywood, and I'd like to adapt. It was a story called The Woman in the Room, which is one of King's more like, you know, oddly enough, it's one of his more Shawshank-y kind of stories.
Talk about a nothing title.
Yeah. Like, The Woman in the Room.
In the Room.
But, you know, it's a dour story about, like, a son and his mother is dying and, you know, a slow and painful death in the hospital. And, like, it's an assisted suicide story, really. Wow. But it's, it's all in these characters' heads. And he was just like, I think at the time, he's like, nobody in Hollywood's ever going to option this. So, sure, you can have it for a buck or whatever, and that kind of became the Dollar Baby thing. That you talked about on writing, you get a really good feel of King as a person from reading that. You said there's not a whole lot of people who will write a this is how you write a book or, you know, tell a narrative or become a real deal author stories that also include, you know, the person telling you this all about the time the babysitter sat on his head and farted on him. You know, it's like, right. You know, there's something, you know, that's always very real and down to earth and down home about King. And that comes through in his writing, comes through, you know, in his interviews, it comes through in, in his essays and stuff that he, you know, where he's actually teaching you. You get a little feeling of that teacher that connected with kids before he became a famous writer there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, can you tell us about the horror elements of your other film that you wrote, that Jorma Taccone directed, Over Your Dead Body?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that one is a lot more.
Yeah, this is a lot more horror influence on that.
It could take place in backwoods Maine. You don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, who's to say it's not Castle Rock? It's an adaptation. It's a remake of a Norwegian movie called The Trip, or called Eond Dogger, which does not mean The Trip, but they called it The Trip when it was on Netflix. So if you are searching it and want to see it, I think it's like for better or for worse, and it's like for worse, I think, is something like that.
Right.
I could be wrong. It'd be hysterical if I said that confidently and was wildly wrong.
I have no idea what Eond Dogger means.
But so, yeah, it's a movie about a husband and a wife who've both planned to kill each other on the exact same day, and hijinks ensue. And what we loved about this, I mean, in terms of writing it, we loved the original, and it's particularly like the story structure of the original we thought was really great. And so we really didn't want to change things just to change them. And we were really hired for just a dialogue polish. And then we ended up changing more than that. So we got the credit, but like, we really weren't looking to change things just to change things. We just were like, you know, how do we put our spin on this? How do we, you know, just tell this story in our way? And one thing, you know, speaking to your question about the horror influences, thing I love about this movie and what I've really come to appreciate about movies more recently is like, I don't particularly love realism in movies. I like it at times. Obviously, in certain movies you want it, but like, part of me is like, I don't know, we're in a make-believe world, like, let's go big, like, we're here, like, if you're gonna have some blood and gore, like, don't, you know, don't give me a half measure, really, really go nuts with it. And so we really leaned into that, and just, and the original's pretty gory and gory in, like, I think kind of a fun Tarantino way of gore. And so we just, like, we're like, yeah, how do we take that even further? How do we have even more fun with some of these deaths and
Yorma
violence?
Really didn't want that thing to happen, where often the American remake is like kind of a flaccid version of what the original was. He like wanted to go even harder.
Well, you know, I said it's like one of those comedies based on like a warring couple, like the War of the Roses, right? But it also, it seems like it's like a combination, maybe spoof too, of there's a genre of horror film where strangers show up at a cabin and terrorize people.
Yeah.
The strangers, yeah. there's the Paul Tremblay novel, Cabin at the End of the World. I don't know if you guys have read that, but it was made into a movie called Knock at the Cabin. Three strangers show up.
Yep.
You know, bloodshed ensues. Or Funny Games. You guys have probably seen that one. Like, is it a home invasion
in an isolated space kind of thing?
Yeah. In the woods, like Cabin in the Woods. Is it? Did you see it sort of as a combination of those elements, like the relationship, I hate you comedy, and the strangers terrorizing you?
I mean,
what if the strangers were Coen Brothers characters? Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we love that with both of our films. They kind of start in a certain genre and then kind of twist it on you a little bit. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, what we did with Over Your Dead Body, you know, it starts with this, we wanted to set this real relationship story up, and, you know, it's this, it's kind of dramatic, it's kind of comedic, and then all of a sudden when the three prisoners show up, it becomes this home invasion story, and then everything kind of changes. The tone, the style, it becomes very scary, and it's like all of a sudden you're like, whoa, am I in a different movie than I was in the first quarter of this film for the middle section? And then at the end, when it gets all blood and guts and like wild, you're sort of in a different movie for that part of the movie as well. So yeah, we did sort of know we wanted to kind of change the tone and, you know, kind of bring people into this movie where they were maybe into this more lighthearted fare, and then all of a sudden it gets really, you know, you're all of a sudden in this hopefully tremendously scary moment where you're worried about the actual survival of these two people, these deranged Coen Brothers-esque escaped prisoners.
There's a ton of tonal shifts in Over Your Dead Body, and it's the type of thing like that, and just also connected to Pete's movie, meta humor, which we do in that movie, are things that are definitely not for everybody, but they are for me in such a big way. I love when a movie's tone, you can't totally pin it down. And I think there's something that, particularly with horror, that is so additive to that. Like, I think Funny Games is like a perfect example. It's like so unsettling, that whole movie, because you're like, are there comedic elements to this? Is it all horror? And it's like, because of that, it's so much scarier than like a Conjuring movie, where you know exactly what that is. And that's not to shit on that at all. But like, I think Funny Games just never lets you relax into the movie for a second. It's just constantly like changing, you know, even the rules of reality change in a very crazy moment in the middle of that movie. And I think that we've always felt like if you make people laugh in a drama, they're going to laugh even harder. If you scare people in a comedy, they're going to be even more scared because you're not expecting that. And I feel like surprise is such a big, important part of film, that having, you know, tonal shifts really underscores
one
that.
Genre can elevate the other if you do it right.
Was there something also in this movie with Jason Segel and Samara Weaving as the warring couple that is a metaphor for modern America, where we're sort of a divided political class, and then an external threat comes in, like we're at each other's throats, and then an external threat comes and and it unites us again?
If you saw that, then yes. Yeah. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
That was intended.
If that
then that was
smart
intended.
To viewers, then yes, that is what we were trying.
I'm just bullshitting you. I just thought it would be fun to like throw the most pointy-headed, unfunny analysis of the movie out and see what your reaction would be. Yeah, no.
I love Yorma. This is, you know.
Yeah, us too.
I interviewed him a ton back in my Ain't It Cool days, and like got along. I'm just on the wave, you know, that dude's wavelength, you know. But I love that this is, a different taste for him, right? And I love that, you know, this MacGruber's one of the funniest movies that's ever been made. I think that that's, you know, the one of the best things ever. But like, I love that he's, you know, he's doing something a little bit different here, and I like that it's unpredictable. I like that it has a foot in reality in one moment, and then like kind of the more absurd stuff that he's known for in the other. And like, I don't know. It's just like I was very impressed when I saw it at South by, of like cool. This is, you know, him getting to stretch his wings a little bit as a filmmaker too.
Which, yeah, totally. Cool. And he was such a massive influence on us, like with The Lonely Island and the digital shorts at SNL were like incredibly formative to us. And you know, when working together was like a dream come true. And because of that, we were so influenced by him. We had such an immediate shorthand with him. And also, like, I think a lot of directors who would approach this movie would cut out some of the weirder jokes that we put in there, would certainly like pull us back from some of the more comedic moments. And so when he was there, we were like, oh, this is great. He's going to lean into it. And we like, And also, you're worried that a director's not going to be able to hit your humor a lot of the time. We write a very specific style of comedy that is very technical and precise. And if it's not done right and at the right rhythm, it will not work. And so when Yorma took control of the movie, when he was attached as a director, we were like, oh, this is great. We can, you know, throw him some curveballs that we know he'll now be able to hit.
Yeah, it's, you know, you're worried when you write a script like that, like what director can be funny but also be gruesome and all that stuff. And when they got Yorma, it was, like Nick said, it was really great because obviously humor, I mean, come on, they're at the top of their game. I mean, Lonely Island is sort of why we got into doing sketch comedy. But doing MacGruber and doing genre and doing violence well comedically but also playing into the genre and committing to it, it's like who else could have really done this? So, yeah, Yorma was a really, really great find.
I got a fun Yorma story. I knew his reputation from Lonely Island and SNL, but the first time I met him and spoke to him, he was covered head to toe in fur with crazy monkey teeth on the set of Land of the Lost.
Oh, you could have said at a premiere, and I'd have been like, yeah, yeah, sure, yeah.
And he's like Sunday Chaka. Best. What was that? What was that little monkey guy called?
I think it was Chaka, right?
Chaka, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just remember talking to him. So now whenever I see him, like at the movie premiere, he got up and gave an intro. And I was like, oh, right, of course, he's not. Like, whenever I see him in any movie or something, it's like when an actor is, you discover they have, like, an Australian accent in real life, and then you see them interviewed. It's like, oh, yeah.
You're you're not a monkey in real life.
Oh, yeah. Just first, every time I see his name or hear his name, I think of him as the little monkey guy. And I'm always surprised that he's human, but that's nice to see.
Brian or Nick should have been, we're surprised he's human sometimes, too. That was,
yeah, I mean, I don't know if he is.
We got to get the headlines.
The jury's still out.
Yeah.
And Yorma's an alien.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me in the least.
To steer it back to Stephen King country, how did we choose The Dead Zone as your King topic for the show?
I mean, there's a lot of different Stephen King that we could absolutely talk about. You guys have covered so much of it. It was actually our mutual friend and publicist on the call, Greg Longstreet, who was like, you guys should do The Dead Zone. I love this movie. Mm-hmm. And we'd never seen it. And so it was like, yeah, let's do like a first watch, first reaction to it.
Great.
That was so, it. Yeah, I mean, many decisions when you make a movie. It's like, it's overwhelming, even in this like process right now of doing all this press, that I was like, someone just choose a Stephen King movie for me. And Greg was like,
give me the assignment. Don't make me think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I was very happy just to get something.
So what did you think you were getting into with this movie? Like, when you hear The Dead Zone, David Cronenberg,
one thing that's interesting
Walken,
to me
I didn't
is
know
like,
at all.
I was like, okay, The Dead Zone. I bet it's like a guy who goes to a zone where there's dead people.
Zombies. You're expecting zombies.
Yeah. Did not seem to be anything in the movie, unless I blinked and missed it, that would qualify as The Dead Zone. Like, It's a very interesting title. I imagine in the book it's maybe more like connected to that name.
They talk about it towards the end. He goes, I saw those visions, and there was a vision. Part of it I couldn't see. Oh yeah, the dead zone. And then the place where he can change, maybe.
That's an invention for the movie too, though.
Right.
Not how it is in the book. In the book, the dead zone is we find out Johnny Smith has a brain tumor that's killing him, and the brain tumor itself is the dead zone within the book. It is really bizarre.
That's very different.
That makes so much sense, though, because that's kind of what it felt. That's what my thought was, like, in the book, the dead zone it means something different, or is more defined.
I have a question about, maybe the book answers this more. In this movie, you know, he gets like this headache on the roller coaster at the beginning, right? That's kind of the first sign that something's up. And then he's in this coma for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we're both necessary. It's almost like normally, it almost feels like there's two inciting events of what could have sparked this superpower in him. And I was like, was the coma necessary? Like, if you took the coma out and it was just he had these headaches and all of a sudden he started getting these powers, is that... I don't know. It's a very interesting thing. It almost feels like they both are trying to do something here.
What the coma does is it pauses him and allows everyone else in his life to move on.
He
wakes up and he doesn't really have a place in the world anymore. So you need
that. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Story-wise, that does help. But I almost felt like, oh, there's going to be something learned from the coma about why he has these powers. But no, it's nothing about that at all. It's just to move life on.
It's definitely interpreted in the movie more as... he is put into the coma, and that's why he has these powers. Even though you do get that moment on the roller coaster, that's underlined way more in the
book. Like it's something that's been lying dormant in you that was woken up.
It's a little bit, and I'm sure you could read it as like the coma, like the door was open a crack, and the coma pushed it fully open. In the book, there's even like a scene with a psychic, where like a shell game kind of thing, shell game psychic-y thing.
Oh, he loves that
he
stuff.
He picks the right number and, you know, and all this stuff over and over again, where it's a little bit more like this is just a natural power. And this is Stephen King in this era of like Firestarter, where that's where he's really interested in like these, you know, Carrie. It's... The Shine and The Shining is like all dormant, you know, powers of stuff. Mm-hmm. He moves away a little bit from that, but like his early work is very much all about, you know, these especially young people with powers.
I wonder if he had the same problem you fellas had on Pizza Movie with the title. Like he had this story about a psychic, and he was like, "Guys, what should we call this book?" And they're like, "You know, Twilight Zone. Anything with three words in the zone is gonna connect our people, our readers." Call it the Pizza Zone.
How long is the book? Is it one of his longer books, or is it like a... Like, what I was curious about was, like, you know, he there's the serial killer in Castle Rock, and then there's the political candidate, the
episodic
the Martin
nature
Sheen.
Of everything.
Yes, the episodic
the
nature
kids,
is very interesting.
There's like a three-act thing, where, like, there's the serial killer is the first act, then there's the...
The kids, yes. I was curious if there were more things in the book, or...
Those are the main things. In the book, instead of hockey kids who drown, it's like teenagers at a house party that gets struck by lightning and they burn to death.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. It's like a graduation
I feel like
party.
That's a lateral move, I think, either way. Sure.
Yeah.
So I think it was like, you know, maybe... I don't know why Cronenberg changed it, maybe teenagers burning up in a house was too carry, you know?
Could be.
Sure.
And he was like, let's just make it ice. The ice is going to break.
Was it a TV show also?
It was, Michael Hall.
It definitely felt like, it almost felt like the movie is setting up a TV show of... like, or did it come before, did this movie come before or after the TV show?
Oh, well before.
It felt like, because it was just, I was like, oh yeah, I could totally see this as a TV show. It's just like a different thing
each week. And his powers.
Yeah, it's like the Ghost Whisperer, right? Like the psychic solves the crime of the week.
The TV show is not bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's actually pretty good for its time and for what it, what TV was when that was out. It was actually kind of a step between like what TV is now and what like the typical CW kind of show was back then. But they do the thing that that TV has to do when you're doing multiple seasons, where the Greg Stilson and Johnny are super good friends for like the first four seasons, like how Lex was friends with Clark and everything, you know what I mean? In Smallville, you know, they follow that thing, which I don't think plays off as well. I like the Greg Stilson of the movie. Better.
I loved the ending of it. I thought that was such a fun kind of how it shakes out, or just specifically, spoiler alert, the politician grabbing the child and using him as this human shield. I thought was such a fun way of like defeating the politician.
Well, the only effective way I would imagine, because you know what I mean, we've seen it, you know, on all sides of the political spectrum, but like when somebody is assassinated, you know, they become martyrs, right?
Right.
And it's only strengthens, it tends to strengthen the cause, whether it's, you know, in the civil rights movement, you know, all the civil rights leads getting assassinated is what actually, you know, ultimately pushed through, you know, the legislation. Well, we've seen it more recently, you know, with the Charlie Kirk stuff. It's like, you know, they will elevate the people that, you know, that are killed. You know,
I remember reading the book and feeling like, okay, I know this is going to go one of two ways. He's going to kill the politician, or he's not, and the world is going to end.
Right.
I didn't know which way it was going to go, because at that point, when I was just a kid when I was reading these, and I had read Pet Sematary, which has the really bleak ending, and then It, which has the hopeful, like, hey,
that's
we
what
won.
I love about Stephen King is you don't know. He's like very much willing to leave you feeling
that's that thing he does.
He's
like, it's going to end where it ends.
Yeah. It's because he doesn't know. Yeah, he doesn't.
I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised that he came up with like a third way. Like he doesn't kill him, but defeats him another way by, you know, making people see what a craven, cowardly son of a bitch he is. But I read that Steve said that the reason he came up with that ending was he didn't want somebody to shoot a politician and then say, well, I read it in this book.
Right.
Oh, you know? Yeah. That's
but I'm like,
smart.
That challenge he had, I don't want to actually shoot the guy, but I do want to defeat him, like, forced him to come up with a more creative solution.
Yeah. I did have the thought when he was like, like you see him going off to kill him, I was like, holy shit, maybe try something else first. Like maybe try and, like, I don't know, get involved in his opponent's cause. Like let's
have
maybe try a couple
the neighborhood.
Options.
Well, I mean, I think in the book, because it becomes more established that he's on a clock, you know, he's gonna die soon, and like, you know, he's going to do it anyway, so you know, this is the only sure thing that he can do on his way out, right? But what's interesting to me about this, and what I always look at the ending here, and I've started to see people have picked this up. I saw somebody actually talking about this on social recently, talking about the parallels between Stilson and Trump, right? You know, it's the populist politician, the guy that wears a slogan on a hat, and it becomes the this kind of groundswell movement and getting people to vote who might not normally vote, and bringing out a lot of the worst in people, and ultimately being everything that, you know, all of us on the left have been, you know, screaming about and, you know, trying to warn people up for
He's
forever.
He's very Trumpy.
But people have been brought up, like, the ending here, and have said, like, if the exact same thing happened to Trump and he held up a human shield, his approval rating would go up.
Yeah, I know. It would not.
All the spin would be like, you know, so I think I saw somebody say, no, the spin would be, you'd hear everybody on the right go, he wasn't using that baby as a shield, he was throwing him to safety. And it was
exactly.
It was just
or
all
the baby had
it
coming.
It was an Antifa
fuck
baby
babies.
Or something.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, it's like it's weirdly non-cynical, you know, this resolution, you know.
It was a different time when that maybe would have helped.
With the magazine cover that's like, he's finished. And I'm like, I've seen so many, like, Trump's finished magazine headlines that have just not proven
to
be true.
It used to be true before 2016 when a headline would come out like that. It would probably have some stake. It was a great moment in the movie when he goes to shake his hand and he gives him the button. And you just know, like, oh, there's something there. It's a good piece of like, oh, what you're given the knowledge as a viewer, like, oh, you're going to want to see him shake that guy's hand because there's something important to know, but you're not getting it yet. It's just very efficiently done.
Ultimately, this movie's a tragedy, which is why I love that Cronenberg was the one to do it.
I admire Cronenberg's restraint at not having cockroach people or anything like that in this movie.
He still had to throw in that scissor suicide.
I love the scissor suicide. Yeah. That was great.
I was also like, no way that kills that guy.
I never watched it.
Is that in the book, the scissor suicide?
Yeah.
I think it is.
It felt like the way King would kill someone.
Doesn't he have a different like weapon that he uses in the book, the slasher Dodd? It wasn't just his throat or something. Yeah, it wasn't just scissors though, wasn't it? It's been a minute since I've read it, so I don't know.
That's interesting because that felt so Stephen King-y, like the special pair of scissors in his coat, like. So it'd be wild if that was a Cronenberg thing, but it would also be amazing.
But what's interesting when you watch this movie, and I'm very curious. Actually, one of the things I want to talk about with you guys is the movie's reputation before you got to it. Because I think specifically because of walking on SNL that, you know, that a lot of people think the movie is going to be a little bit more crazy walking than it is going into it.
He's a leading man. He's a handsome, really intense dude. Like, it really feels like a different guy than how we know walking. At least that's how I felt. I mean, he has moments, obviously, of like, you know, screaming that are pretty amazing and kind of hilarious. But I felt like, you know, it's like you almost think you're not going to take it seriously.
And then I bought him after the coma. I was like completely in. This seems exactly right. It's more him as a normal school teacher. I was like, no way.
With the bowl haircut. The big glasses. Teaching Sleepy Hollow, by the way, which
what
funnily
was his
enough.
Vibe at that? I mean, obviously, as we came of age, he was already kooky old man, Christopher Walken. During that time, I mean, Deer Hunter and stuff, like, was he known as, like, kooky yet, or was he just sort of known as, like, just a dude? He already was.
But not to the degree
The Deer Hunter, he was, like, fucked in the head the whole movie, and then worse, because he ends up, you know, trapped in Vietnam, but he's like, he's sort of twisted and warped
and unpredictable. But he isn't. He wasn't that like comedically over the top.
I heard that he was considered for Han Solo, and I think that had he been cast as Han Solo, I think that would change the trajectory of America. I think that's a butterfly effect event that would have so many. Like if Han Solo is Christopher Walken, it's like everything in the world is different.
He was up for that, but you got to think everybody. The reality was everybody who was that age came in and auditioned. They saw hundreds of people that you've never heard of, but like. In there was like Kurt Russell, Christopher Walken, you know, a handful of others.
Kurt Russell makes total sense.
Yeah. his other role, he wasn't famous for this, but he's in Annie Hall as Annie Hall's crazy brother.
Oh, yes, of course. Great performance.
You know,
yes.
And the whole joke is like he talks about how suicidal he is and how he's driving a car and he just wants to veer into oncoming traffic. And then he drives we need a ride afterwards. Back to the airport. So, you know, Christopher Walken will take you.
But also Jeff Goldblum's first role in that movie, Annie Hall.
Yep. I have a theory that the Dead Zone and the reputation of the Dead Zone is kind of what created the Walken that most people and, you know, that I grew up with, that you grew up with. You know, obviously Walken in Pulp Fiction is, you know, that punchline of like his ass or what, you know, when he does it. That is, to me, like a demarcation line in his career, where that's every single indie, every single thing that he's in. Like they play up that quirk. But my theory is that it's his appearances on SNL that really drove that, specifically his sketches that he did making fun of the Dead Zone. You know, because he has, you know, multiple sketches where he's the guy that he can foresee the future, but only like insignificant things.
Right.
And so it's just like, you're going to eat an ice cream too fast. You know, it's going to hurt. You're right here, real bad. You know, it's like, and I think that, you know, in a weird way, the Dead Zone would have a big ripple effect in his career, because specifically because he became known more as that caricature of what's ultimately in that movie is very serious, very, very era appropriate walk-in, right? Yeah. You know, but then the spoof that he did, the self spoof, kind of became what his persona was for, you know, the latter half of his career.
I had such an interesting like watching it just immediately. I was just like, oh God, I miss movies that look like this. Mm-hmm. I like so much of the look was so like weirdly comforting and nostalgic and great
like that too.
And then at the same time, I also was like, I don't miss movies that sound like this. I don't miss, I'm so glad at the advancements in sound technology where I can't, I'm not as aware of what's ADR'd and not.
I love that shot of the, when they're exploring the tunnel and the glistening rock, the
rock. I remember saying out loud, "That is, this shot is beautiful. It really, the lighting was great. Whatever that tunnel was like made of.
You can feel the cold because there's snow. Like you could feel that. Mm-hmm.
The breath. The glistening wetness of everything. Everything's just watered down. Yeah.
And then water on that.
There's so much visual stuff in this movie that is really impactful. I mean, even just the silhouette of Johnny Smith, you know, he's got the cane, he's lanky and tall, he's got the kind of weird hair, he's got the popped collar on his jacket.
I loved the cane. I thought that was such a fun, like, just his, like, limp was such a fun bit of texture to the character.
So much, yeah.
It was like a young man who's somehow an old man.
You know, if I'm interrupting a KingCast episode for a mid-roll ad read, that could only mean one thing. It's once again time to sing the praises of our show's longest sponsor, Lumi Gummies. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or, like me, help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. Lumi Gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you want to take the edge off or get a little relaxed creative boost, they have an option for you, and they all taste good, which is something you can't say for most edibles. I've been a customer of theirs since the very first time they advertised on the show, and I can tell you their product has only gotten better over the years. My personal favorite is called Orange Cream Cookie. It's a sativa gummy, and for whatever reason, that is the one that really gets me in that nice, calm, relaxed mood that helps me get to sleep at a reasonable hour. Keeps me off my vampire sleep schedule, but I can tell you, having sampled all of them, you can't go wrong with any of their styles or flavors. Lumi Gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com, that's LumiGummies.com, and use the code KingCast for 30% off of your order. That's right, 30%. That's LumiGummies.com, code KingCast. LumiGummies.com, code KingCast. Now let's get back to the show. And I like the sadness that throughout the entire movie. That's something that I don't think gets a lot of focus, unfortunately. But you know, when I called it a tragedy earlier, but when you really break it down, you know, something that is really underlined in the adaptation, which is present in the book but not as on the forefront, is that, you know, Johnny Smith in the book is a little bit more proactive. Like, he's going out and trying to find politicians and shake their hands and see if they're a good egg or not, right? I think even in the book, he shakes Jimmy Carter's hands and goes, oh, this is a good guy. Like, just down deep in his heart, you know, he's a good guy. Where here, this is a character who is drawn to helping people, and he's drawn to, you know, sometimes his other baser human instincts of, like, you know, that reporter that's being a dick to him, you know, when he's coming out and he really, it's like, oh yeah, oh, by the way, your sister killed herself, how do you feel about you know, it's like, fuck you, you know, you know, he kind of becomes a little trollish in that moment, which is very authentic, you know, too. It's like, you know, when you're faced with asshole people, you want to be an asshole back. But what I really appreciate about this film, and the more I watch it, the, you know, the sadder it is to me, that every single time he ends up helping somebody, he loses something in his life. It's like, you know, all he wants is to be that teacher, that mentor, but every time he helps somebody, he has to give something up. It just really, to me, underlines that tragedy of that character who, you know, and it makes you think, if you were in that situation, knowing that you would have to sacrifice, that every time you do this and you get that moment of, oh, I solved this and I helped whatever this is, you know, now suddenly you can't be considered to be a teacher anymore because you've been in the news helping catch a serial killer or whatever, you know, like, would you withdraw? Would you, you know, or would you, you know, feel the weight of that closet full of letters at begging for help from everybody, you know?
Right. And it also feels like it he kind of gets sicker each time. Is that right? Or is it like it's a good actual conflict for a character when he's, you know, when he's debating whether or not to do it in the beginning, you're like, oh, I kind of see, like, you understand both sides of this, why it's good for humanity for he does it, but also personally, it's going to, like, fuck him up in multiple ways.
I like that the movie makes a very strong argument for having premarital sex. Or you're going to get paralyzed. Yeah, you're going to get killed.
You never know when a milk truck's going to swing by and just smash into you.
I also love something about, like, the dialogue. Stephen King's dialogue is so interesting to me because I feel like it's so – his books are so easy to read. You read them so quickly. There's something that, like – and I think part of it is that, like – I feel like 85% of the sentence is, like, familiar. You kind of understand it. You're like, I get it totally. It's easy. And then the other 15%, there's a wild choice thrown in there of just even, like, sometimes it's, like, a weird word. Like, in the scene when his mom, when he wakes up from the coma and his mom, the words his mom uses to tell him that his wife has... or that his girlfriend has, you know, moved on in the 5 years that he was in the coma, is she's cleaved to another man.
Which that mom is very interesting.
That is the wildest way of saying it. Made me go, like when she said that, I actually thought that what the concept of the movie was is, like, oh, he's still in the coma, and everything that we're seeing now is, like, in his mind, and his mom is, like, a weird demon or something like that. Because I was like, have never heard the word cleaved used by certainly a mom.
But she's, like, a kind of crazy, or not crazy, but just sort of intense, old-school fundamentalist Protestant, right? So I think that's one of those.
Like,
no, in the backwoods, isolated community phrases that thee and thou she probably uses too.
Yeah, of course.
It was also interesting just figuring out as the movie goes, like, what his power actually is. Because, you know, it's the first one is, you know, you see the girl in the burning house. That's the first one, right? Yeah. So it's like, it's something that's happening right then. Mm-hmm. And then it's like he sees the doctor's past as a kid.
Right.
And then you see future. So I was like constantly like, oh, wait, what's happening here? So when it goes to the future, it was like a new, I don't know if they, like, make it clear in the book, like, he can kind of see any part of life of this person, past, present, and future, or if it also grows with time, where the future's sort of a...
No, you're right.
A reveal.
It's like he could just sort of see outside of time, right? The whole span. I love the bit with Herbert Lom as his doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, Wezak,
I kind of so think of Wezak. It's so sad that he, with his mom... Like, that was really, I've got a 1.5 year old child, and I was just like, this is really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Oh, when he calls her and doesn't.
Yeah, when they don't reconnect, it's like,
he just says, like, I'm going to leave it be the way it was. And, you know, that's.
Yeah.
I think Herbert Lom gives a really great performance. I'm used to seeing him as the, like, flabbergasted supervisor for Inspector Clouseau in
right, Dreyfus, right? Yeah.
You know, and, like, he's really good in this.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just going to talk about the Herbert Lom moment here that, like, is to me the heart of the movie, which is, you know, that conversation he has with Johnny about Hitler. Would you go back in time and kill Hitler? And I love how he plays it, because he's just like, you know, as a, you know, as a man, you know, yeah, absolutely kill that, you know, I'd kill that son of a bitch. But he goes through this whole, like, you know, philosophical talk, and, like, as a doctor, I help people and don't hurt people. And it's like, but yeah, no, I'd kill that son of a bitch.
Man, I would stick this in his heart. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's that thing, Nick, you were saying, like, where it starts out a certain way and then, like, the dialogue reverses. Like, he gives him the whole, Hippocratic oath, basically. Yep. Like, oh, I'm sworn to protect and heal people. I could not take a life deliberately as a doctor.
But some dude's gotta get going.
Yeah.
But to the point of the movie, you know, maybe that would have opened the door. Maybe cutting the head off of the Hydra in that instance wouldn't have ended everything, you know?
Right.
It would have made things worse. King explores this a little bit later with 11-22-63 as well. I've never read it,
but I mean, I know people love it.
It's so good. It's all about this is a time travel story about a guy that goes back in time to try to prevent the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
And it is so good. It's a big old honking book, but like if you got a big trip coming up, you know, throw it on the Kindle. It's legit one of his best.
It is. Did any of you notice this? I think I'm probably wrong about this, but I did think so. The guy that plays his physical therapist or whatever, who's like, you know, here's how you use the crutches, and then he's like, I'm gonna go run a lap, I'll see you in a bit. It's like there's something about that that made me go, this guy is gonna come back in some way. And then in the news footage of them talking about the serial killer, I swear to God, that actor is in the background. And I'm probably wrong, and it's like a guy that looks like him. But it made me go, oh, he's going to be this serial killer. And then obviously he wasn't. But I was like, and it made me, it went like, I don't think that was a good choice to put that guy in the news footage, because now I know he's going to be the serial killer, and I'm completely wrong.
I didn't notice that at all, but like that, it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, I think especially Cronenberg of this era might want to pepper in faces in there to throw off the scent. Cause I mean, Dodd is pretty obvious, you know, he's not obvious. Well, he's obvious in hindsight. Like when you watch how Cronenberg shoots that sequence that we're talking about in the tunnel where Johnny's trying to touch the cigarette pack or whatever, right? And trying to get a feel off of that. If you watch that actor's performance as Dodd, the deputy or whatever, you see how nervous he is. You can see how he's playing it. And by the way, that actor was who Cronenberg wanted to play Johnny Smith. He's a Canadian actor, yeah. And I think that it was a studio going, no, we got to get a star in this role. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Also, knowing that era of filmmaking, crowd scenes were expensive. If you wanted to have people in a scene, you had to pay for them. So he was probably like, hey, can you guys like...
Get everyone reviews in the background.
We did a thing like that. This is a very dumb story. Brian and I went to NYU together. I was in acting and Brian was in film. And the way we really started working together is Brian would cast me in his movies and then I would improvise. And then we liked kind of the amalgamation of both of our minds. And there was one short film that Brian did called Zebra Wish.
Don't worry about that title. Don't ask any questions.
I remember it was like 2 a.m. and Brian was like, all right, so this scene takes place at a party. And we were filming it in my dorm room at like 2 a.m. We had one other person. And I was like, how on earth are you going to make this feel like a party scene? Like there's nobody in the room. And Brian was like, it's dark enough that what we'll have you do is when we're not on your coverage, I went behind the other actor and turned away from him and like was just like in the background. I was an extra in the background of a different shot in a scene that I was in.
We're like cutting to the POV of your character and you're in the background of the shot.
The audience doesn't know. It's totally fine.
The audience may have known. No people. Which audience? I don't know.
Yeah, what audience?
Eventually for this movie. You know, is the book as episodically structured? I assume it is, as the movie. Because I think what was interesting was when I thought it was going to be like he's going to be hired for the police and become a detective for the police. That's sort of what it felt like the plot was going to become. And then when he discovers the gazebo case and he figures that out, then we kind of move on and it becomes like, oh, he's using it for multiple different people. And then, of course, it ends with the politician. Does the book kind of thread the politician storyline throughout to kind of keep that?
Like, he's throughout. Because
the movie, it dollops it through, and then the second half, it really kind of focuses more on it. But I was wondering, how does the book feel in comparison to the movie in terms of like its episodic structure?
It does kind of cut to Stilson, and you see his rise, like from like a Bible salesman who kicks a dog to death, like that.
Yeah, your introduction to Stilson is him going door to door selling Bibles and murdering a dog that he's annoyed by.
And you see his rise. Like, King tells you right from the get go, this is a horrible man. So you know that, like, as he's rising up as a politician.
Yeah. And I think it just became a narrative imperative for the movie adaptation to never leave Johnny's POV. You only do it once. There's one time in the entire movie where the audience knows something Johnny Smith doesn't, and that's that shakedown that Stilson does of the reporter that's about to do the story on him.
Yeah, that's right.
And it feels weird. Like, I remember as a kid, you know, because I watched this movie a lot. It was one of those recurring cable movies, right, when I was growing up. And I remember that scene always felt weird to me. And then it wasn't until, you know, examining it, really, that you see that every single other scene in the movie you're only with Johnny Smith, you know, every single scene except for that one. And so it feels odd. It feels like a different movie somehow, you know, this shakedown that happens where you're getting this peak.
Yeah.
Because even Johnny Smith's ex, you know, you would imagine we would learn more about her home life or whatever, but you don't. You're just with Johnny. So when her husband comes knocking at the door, you don't know it's her husband, just like Johnny doesn't know it's her husband, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was also wondering if she had more in the book than in the movie, because obviously love of his life, and then at the end there's that tragic, you know, I love you thing. But then she comes back, and it feels like there's this implied sex scene, perhaps. And then she leaves, and she sort of
pops in. Sure.
Definitely, right? Okay, cool.
And no question.
Thank God. But it's like, it is one of those things where I was like, oh, this is, she's sort of planted a few times and then comes back to the end. And it's like, I was just wondering in the book if that's developed more, or if it's sort of the same amount.
It is. That's why I say that time break where he's out of life, like he's in the coma, is important, at least for the heart of the story, is that this isn't a guy who just got sick, got a brain tumor, or had an accident and suddenly can see things. Like, this is a guy who got removed, and I'd have to read it again to see if the dead zone is partly that too, like he was in a dead zone for like 5 years and the world moved on without him, and then he never really just had a place there and was struggling to catch up. But she's the big loss, that he didn't take advantage, so to speak, he didn't use the opportunity he had to, like, be with her. He said they part ways, and so then he has his accident. And the whole thing is like missed opportunities. Is that I actually think, like, what makes the book powerful is when he finally decides to stand up against this politician and take him out in some way. It's him making the choice to stop being passive, stop asking other people to save the hockey team or the kids from the fire. Stop, you know, he kind of resists helping the police with the serial killer, right? Like, he doesn't want that. So he finally, like, each step, each stage of those three stages is him, okay, fine, I'll get involved. Okay, I do see this. I'm going to try and get you to stop it. And then he decides, I'm going to stop it myself. And so it's the story of a guy who really becomes active in his own life, even though it's moved on. And she's the one that got away, the missed opportunity. And I think it has the most beautiful ending of any of his books, with a letter that Johnny writes to her. And you read that while she's visiting his grave, and she feels his presence near her by the grave. Mm-hmm. And she says, like, same old Johnny, and walks away. And it's like, oh, it's this heartbreaking thing. And the letter has these beautiful lines, like, maybe nothing is lost that can't be found again. And it's all about him trying to reconnect and trying to find a place in the world. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I guess you could argue he does, but he does it by sacrificing himself. So.
Yeah.
He becomes part of the world, finally, that has left him behind in that moment.
She's a very important part in that, though, you know?
That
this is something he lost, someone he loved and lost.
By not acting. Yeah. What is that scene in the book when, like, in the movie, it's the... you know, some things are better waiting for, or whatever. Like, how much do they go into that, or that first one?
At the beginning, or when?
Yeah, the kiss in the rain scene.
No.
Yeah, I think it's like there's waiting and then there's stalling. You know, like, there's being respectful and being like
yeah
too shy, too afraid to act. You know. And I'm sure we all have those. I think it's a very human thing, right? Is that you,
totally.
Yeah.
You know, you can be overly aggressive in the things you pursue, the people, the career goals, all of that, or you could be too passive. Like, you can be too inert. Yeah. And finding that right balance, I think, is like one of the themes of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember if they make like a bigger deal of it pre-accident, but I mean, there are a lot of things pre-accident where it's all about setting up that pause that you're talking about, that it's all about, you know, here's this promising future. Everything tomorrow is looking great. And then tomorrow doesn't come. Right.
Mm. Yeah.
And so, I mean, so much of that is, you know, just King's way, I think, of getting you into, you know, Johnny's headspace when he wakes up and mourning what could have been and what lost, what would have been lost just as much as the character is. Right.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, it's definitely there intentionally, but you know, I don't know if there's a huge, huge, like underlying moment at the beginning that really stands out that wasn't, you know, incorporated in the movie ultimately. So what did you guys think of the movie, like, as a whole when you finished it? Were you like, okay, I'm glad that homework assignment's done, I can move on? Or were you, is this like new favorite somewhere in between? Like, what's your thoughts?
I really liked it, and I think talking to you guys has made me like it even more. Like, I feel like just the perspective you guys are bringing, and also knowing some things from the book that have sort of, like, there's a thing about, like, this is the book to movie adaptations in general. It's like with a book, you basically a book has a narrator, which is anytime someone's not talking dialogue, what you're saying, whether you're telling the audience emotions or opinions or hitting the theme, you got to take out for a movie and just sort of hope it shows up, which is kind of a beautiful part about filmmaking. But just knowing kind of more these, and also the scenes that have to be cut, I'm like now understanding this movie a bit more. And
yeah, it's what do you makes said me about almost want to watch it again. Action and inaction, like, I had not necessarily tied his relationship with his girlfriend to the assassination at the end, but now it's like, now that you say it, I'm like, oh yeah, oh, that's wonderful, that's so clear now, which is, I think, you know, what a really good critic does is they show you a way of looking at a movie that you hadn't seen before. Like, and I think I love that. I think it's, in terms of like Cronenberg and King, this is certainly not my favorite offering from either of them, but I love it's like, you know, somewhere in the middle probably, I think, for me. And I love those movies, or like, are those things where it's like, you know, I there's not many people I've done this with where I've looked at their entire oeuvre. Like, Truman Capote, I think, is actually the only writer that I've read literally everything they've ever written. And I always, like, there's certain books that, like, In Cold Blood is definitely like my favorite. And then there's like tons of weird essays and like his first book, Other Rooms, Other Voices, something like that. It's like, it's not my favorite, but I love, like, seeing him find things there and seeing him play around. And I think that's, like, what the beauty of Stephen King is, someone who's, like, so prolific, is that they are – I love how prolific Stephen King is, because you get to see him just trying stuff and throwing stuff out there.
Yeah.
So I would say I really enjoyed the movie. It's definitely something I would rewatch and
It's really just such kind of vibe. Like, again, it's that, maybe it's just we've lost it so much, but one, being shot on film, two, the editing style, it's like, I just feel like we really used to settle in the speed of life with movies in a way that we don't anymore. I say, as we make Pizza Movie, the most
pizza movie. If you've seen
the most
pizza
accelerated
movie
that's ever been made, maybe
Pizza Movie is that of like, of I don't know, a freight train
for the first time. But it's just like that kind of like desolate kind of like a sad vibe that sort of just like permeates this film. It like puts you really in a mood the whole time that kind of like, you know, I'm not so creepy necessarily, but just sort of like a little somber, and like just sort of living in that is really, really nice.
Right. I know what you mean, because it's in that opening title sequence, how like the negative space of the title, like these little black shapes start to appear, and then it makes the shape. But it plays out very slowly, and it's over these sort of fall scenes of New England. So you feel that Washington Irving Sleepy Hollow vibe of like, we're we're moving outside of like a city and we're in nature and things are weird and spooky. There's a covered bridge. There's trees shedding their leaves. You feel like you can smell the chimney smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the negative space of the title that gives it its shape. Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool. And it sets you on this pace of like rolling with the homies.
It like settles you in. Before, yeah, to roll
and
the
I think
homies.
Like that where he sets everything, the Castle Rock, you know, type of town, I think is like so perfect for so many Stephen King things. It's such a like, you know, it's like it's all. It feels like it's always fall there,
mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's exactly right for like a horror-y
that's where you want
sci-fi vibe.
It's always, it's always fall. It's always on the surface, looks nice and cozy and neat, and you know there's rot underneath everything.
Yeah.
Speaking of, if I could wave a magic wand and have you two adapt one of his books, I would choose Needful Things.
Do you guys know
Needful Things?
Millions. No, I've never heard of
tell
it.
Tell us. Because we're reading Dark Tower right now.
We're both reading Dark Tower. We're on book two.
It was called The Last Castle Rock Story because it's about the destruction of the town. And a guy moves in. It's like a Faust story where a guy moves in. He's this sort of elemental figure, sort of maybe the devil, maybe not. But he's supernatural in some way. And he opens a secondhand shop that sells items. But the price for the
I've
items
seen this
is,
parodied.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Rick and Morty did a whole parody.
Yes, yes.
Rick
the price of the item
whatever.
Is like it taps into some weakness or some need you have, but then you have to pull what he calls a prank on somebody else. And he gets everybody in the town doing these random pranks against strangers, which they blame on their enemy, and then they all turn on each other. And it's a great... I think it's hilarious.
Have they made a movie of it?
They did.
They did make a movie with Ed Harris and Max von Sydow and Bonnie
Bedelia. Oh, yeah, you gotta have... I wonder who Max von Sydow played. I wonder if he played the
sheriff.
The small town sheriff.
Yeah.
But just because, you know, you handle it so well that especially in Over Your Dead Body, where the two characters are planning to destroy each other, like... The way Needful Things
it's a dark
people.
It's a darkly funny
hold
story
hold on
too.
You're saying Max von Sydow didn't play the devil character?
No,
he played the sheriff?
No, I was joking.
I was like, wait a minute.
Ed Harris was the
yeah
salt
yeah
of
yeah
the
okay
sheriff.
Okay yeah. I took that seriously and I was like what?
Yeah.
Great.
No, he's
yeah,
okay.
So that would be. Yeah, I would absolutely look into that.
That's.
But I love
think
that
you're
you guys,
exactly right. That sounds very much up our alley. That's like a great playground for us to.
It's like
you
mean,
know.
Darkly funny. It's weird as fuck. Some of these things that like one of the things that's a needful thing for one of the residents is a pair of Elvis sunglasses, like actual glasses that Elvis owned. That when she puts it on, she is transported back into like to the heyday of Elvis's hot, sexy youth, and she's like fucking Elvis in a hot tub and stuff. And so every time she puts it on, it's like a drug, right? And she just zones out into this zone. So every you know weird supernatural thing is something different for each person.
Yeah.
It's a baseball
that
card for a little boy. It's you know.
That book didn't get good reviews, and King said he thought the reason it didn't is people didn't get that he was trying to make a dark comedy. They wanted it to be like a realistic drama. Mm. And it's like you said at the top, I think it was you, Nick, or maybe it was
Brian, about
that,
tone.
That you like when a movie says, we don't have to be real, we're a movie. And that's what Needful Things does, which is like, let's take our town and make it, like, what's a... What was that James Gunn movie about the people locked in?
The Belko experiment?
Yeah, it's sort of like, all right, let's take Thornton Wilder's Our Town and then turn it into like a survival horror story.
Yeah.
Where all of the sort of iconic small town figures have to do battle.
Yeah.
So what are you guys thinking of Dark Tower so far? The Dark Tower is one of my ultimate favorites.
So the first book was a bit of a slog.
Mm-hmm,
and then book two, I'm like so in and I'm like loving it.
Book two
which
is
what everyone said.
Yeah,
I mean, it's funny because we also did Three Body Problem recently, which a lot of people were like, book one, people have a problem with, and book two, it really picks up. But it is funny because I know he wrote book one way before the other ones and was even thinking about turning into a
what
series
he did
at that time.
Right, was he went back to book one. Because the thing that I loved about book one that made me – because I was like, I don't – this is not – I'm not enjoying this as much as I did like The Stand, where I just was like, it's so long, but I burned through The Stand. Yeah. Reading The Gunslinger, I was like, I'm having trouble latching onto this. It's it's kind of slower. But then all the like flash forwards, flash backwards were getting me excited. Cause like, I think the thing, something that Brian and I love to do, and you can very much see this in Pizza Movie and Over Your Dead Body, is set up a bunch of stuff early on that calls back in really satisfying ways later. Yeah. And so what I got in The Gunslinger, spoiler alert, but like not really, when it flashes to like New York City and it's this very modern world, I was like, oh, I'm so excited because I know this story is bigger than... this weird Western wasteland kind of thing that like there's, we love like, you know, it's why I love meta humor is because whenever you do something that's really meta and you break the reality or you break some big rule early on, I get very excited because I'm like, oh, this is a world where anything can happen.
I did like the vibe of the first book. I felt like I was in a dream the whole time. But I did remember being like, I don't know if I can take seven books of this.
And then which thankfully book, you don't have to.
We don't have to.
No.
But it was like, I'm intrigued to know if book one like really comes, everything comes back in ways where like all the things that, because a lot of it feels like, do I need to know any of this stuff? But maybe I do, maybe I don't. But but yeah, it was definitely like, I was like, wow, when it's book two kicked in, I was like, that is the longest prologue ever for like a story to start. Like it, but it like,
I'm glad I
went through it.
It does, yeah, because book one is like everything. Book two begins with him waking up on the beach after he, you know, falls asleep on the beach at the end of book one, right? Yes, in terms of callbacks and stuff, that's long been my argument. There's been a debate on the show going back to its origins about, you know, is it better to tell people to start with book two because that's the one that hooks people, or too many people get shaken off by book one. And when you read the story, when you get to the end of the seventh book, you'll understand why I've been a long time proponent of you have to start with book one.
This is crazy.
You have to start with book one. Oh, and
this is,
you know,
getting me fired up.
And because if you don't, you're missing, to me, the whole point of the series if you don't start with that book. And I was a little bit of that toxic fan where I've just been, if you don't love him at his book one, you don't deserve him at his book two. Right?
The book is kind of off. It is off-putting. It's written in a strange, archaic style. It's post-apocalyptic Western, which if you're not into that genre, you're not going to be down for it. But it's a starting point, right? It establishes that as the foundation.
Yeah.
And then book two says, hey, and there are all these other worlds. This is a multiverse story. And you kind of got to start somewhere, you know? Yeah.
It makes the moment when he steps through the door in book two so powerful because you've been lulled into the sense of what you think the world is. Whereas if you just started book two, it'd be like, oh, yeah, I guess this is like, that's the story.
Yeah.
Cool. But you wouldn't be like, oh, you hadn't settled into something else for it to totally rock your world. Yeah, and that kind of makes it.
Yeah. The first book's really very exciting. Episodic because he wrote it as like different. A continuing short story series for was it magazine of science fiction and fantasy, I believe was that. So he wrote like the first, you know, quarter of it, like was published in one issue of that, and then like the next quarter, you know, would be in the next issue and that kind of stuff. So the writing style is really weird in it, and I get it, but I mean, thematically, for character reasons, as you're going to find out, like starting in book one is the way to go.
What's your favorite? What's your guys' favorite? I'm sure you've answered this question a billion times, but book and movie
of Stephen King?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My favorite book is It. Like that's the book that you know that I've probably reread the most outside of Dark Tower stuff. My favorite movie, I kind of go back and forth on it, to be honest, but like Stand By Me, I think is that adaptation gets to the core of what Stephen King's characters are probably the best out of any of the adaptations. And to me that if you can nail that, that's the thing that most people don't get. You can make a brilliant movie like The Shining that misses out on the depth of character, you know, that he had in the book. So for me, it's probably Stand By Me as the movie, and it is the book.
For me, the book is Pet Sematary, and then I'm going to go. I can't argue with Stand By Me, but I will. I'll choose Carrie.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it kicked it off. Well, and I will say, you know, there's a little connection here too, that I think recently The Life of Chuck is also a wonderful adaptation. And I think that that's going to be one in 10 years.
I love that movie. I think, mm-hmm. I'm biased. My wife is in the movie, mm-hmm. but like I so deeply loved that movie, and I was like, and I was saying to her, I was like, I think it's gonna really split people. I think mm-hmm. there's gonna be people who check out because of like there's maybe some more cheesy or earnest moments, right. And I think that'll like you'll lose some people with that. But I was like, the people who love this movie are going to love this movie, and it's gonna take. I don't know if it. I didn't know. Like when it won the audience award at TIFF, I was like, that doesn't surprise me at all. And then when it, I don't know how well it did per se. It didn't like light the world on fire currently, but I feel like I agree. I think in 10 years, all the people who love that movie are going to show their friends who are going to love that movie, and that's going to create a real big audience for
it. The people who love The Life of Chuck make it their whole ass identity. Right?
Yes.
And that's what the ground fire that will ultimately spread, I think. And did you know that you have a connection to the King cast here? Because I share a scene with your wife in that film, technically.
Oh, really?
We should say who Nick's wife is, for people who don't know.
Oh, yes.
Nick is married to Carl Lumley.
Yes.
Wait,
We're very happy together.
No, Mike asked me and the late, great Scott Wampler, who I started the show with, to provide the voices of the NPR hosts that are delivering all the news kind of at the beginning about California falling off into the sea and all that, which is what Karen is listening to in that scene. So technically, my voice shares a...
Yeah, great job.
Shares a scene.
You nailed it. That was great.
Bam. Tell me about it. No, it's... Again, I'm biased as well. You know, I have a deep emotional connection to that movie because, you know, Scott passed away, you know, after doing that, and the movie's dedicated, you know, to him. And so there's always that, you know, we have a physical cameo right before the dance scene where we're behind Tom Hiddleston and, you know, and I'm there with my then girlfriend, now wife, you know, and all this stuff. So there's a bit of a yearbook feeling for this movie, a moment in time that is marked.
Yeah.
That will always have that deep emotional thing, especially given the themes of the film.
Yeah.
You know, about, you know,
I also think a very good thing for that movie is that it didn't like become super, super popular. Cause like there's a world where like that becomes a Best Picture nominee. Right. And I was like, and the backlash would be very unpleasant. Cause I feel like there'd be a whole lot of people who don't like it. And then it would, and it kind of like right now, I feel like it's, you know, people are allowed to love it almost.
Yeah.
I agree. That movie's great.
Guys, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
With the pictures and everything in the future.
Everybody go watch the number one movie on Hulu, I guess. Is that what I heard right before we started recording?
That's what we hear, and Disney
Plus.
Go
see Pizza Movie.
Crazy to say.
You want
for now?
I know I go to Disney Plus to see Ingate and Matarazzo tripping balls looking for Toy pizza. Story.
Yeah, exactly. And many other confused parents who think it's a kids' movie. It is not.
But yeah, they're still giving them clicks and giving the minutes watched that adds up to the still number one movie on Hulu. And everybody, go check out Over Your Dead Body. It is. I hear a lot of, and I know it's a remake, so I know it's weird to say, like, oh, original kind of movies, but, you know, I hear people bitching all the time about everything superhero movies, everything's, you know, just a remake of a remake of a remake. This is a remake of something you probably
haven't seen. Remake.
It's a single remake, but it is a remake of something weird and fun and just wants to give you a good time. And it's the kind of movie that you support these kind of movies in the theater. You're going to get more of them. And so I really want more of these movies. So I want everybody listening to go vote with their bucks, go to the theaters, watch this movie. You're going to be entertained. It's super fun. It goes into some really wild ass places. You get wonderful performances from everybody involved. You got solid writing. I will say at least a solid B minus writing from our team.
Oh, right. We'll say
yes. No. That's a passing grade, everybody.
Passing grade. No, you guys fucking killed it. It's such a fun movie, and I really enjoyed having you guys on the show. So thanks so much.
Thank
for
you
coming
for having
on.
Us. This is great.
Many thanks to Nick Kocher and Brian McElhaney, collectively known as Britannic, not Britannic, as I pronounced it earlier, because I'd never actually heard them say that out loud before. But I really appreciated their conversation. I had a really good time doing this. This is a little fun to break format a little bit and, you know, force these dudes to watch what I consider to be one of the better Stephen King adaptations. So I hope you all enjoyed it. Make sure to check out Pizza Movie if you like funny things. It's on Hulu right now, and you can see Over Your Dead Body in theaters this weekend. I highly recommend both. I dug both. They are both ridiculous. They will make you laugh. Go see them. And speaking of breaking format, the next episode dropping of the KingCast will also be slightly different. We're straying a little bit off of the Stephen King path, but don't worry, we're not straying too far. Our guest wanted to talk about Joe Hill's King Sorrow, which is it's a massive tome about revenge and an asshole dragon that also happens to have a lot of direct connections to his father's work. We don't talk a whole lot about Joe Hill around here, not for... any other reason than, you know, we kind of tend to stick on topic most times, but I'm a big fan of Joe Hill's stuff, and I hadn't gotten around to King Sorrow yet, so this was the perfect excuse. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I would start doing it now. You got a couple of weeks before the next episode drops where we dig into it, but I will say that we do spend about the first half of the episode talking about stuff that is light spoilers, non-spoilery, but the back half, we get into some real spoilery territory, guys. We talk about some deaths. We talk about some themes. We talk about the ending. So, yes, if you've been on the fence, now's the time to pick up King Sorrow, give it a read, and be there in 2 weeks whenever that episode drops. Okay, so the KingCast Patreon, I also got to give a plug to it. It's the best way to support the show. The second best way, of course, is to share the love, rate and review us on whatever podcatcher of your choice, talk about it with your friends, share us on socials. That stuff you can do for free. If you feel like throwing us a few bucks, that goes directly to the show, and you can do it through Patreon. If you dig what we're doing, you'll get 5 years worth of bonus episodes, 90% of which have never been made available outside of the Patreon. You get access to our Discord. You get first dibs on any new bonus episodes, and we got some fun ones coming up. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Throw us a few bucks. It genuinely helps out, and I'd like to think that we give you your value for your money. All right, that should do it. I will see y'all in a couple of weeks for Joe Hill's King Sorrow. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.